This is number 0003, the Stuff File Podcast with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's radio that doesn't fly through the air. Coming from your computer and right into your ear, it's the Stuff File Podcast with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Yes, this is indeed 0003, the Stuff File Podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And we have a full show coming your way for this one-hour podcast. Coming up, we'll meet Mike Armstrong, who is a correspondent for Global National News. He has many stories to tell, including when he covered the Obama inauguration.
I described it on air that day as walking through that crowd and seeing how happy some of the African Americans were in that audience, listening to that speech. I described it as you almost had to put your hand on people's shoulders to keep their feet on the ground. That's how excited people were. And it was pretty interesting because the mall in Washington was once a market where they sold slaves. And there you were on Inauguration Day, Barack Obama taking the Oath of Allegiance. It was incredible.
Walter Noon is on. He shares his unique occupation, that is, he runs a flea circus, and also shares a little about the history of flea circuses. We're going all the way back to the 1500s.
There was a blacksmith, a watchmaker, who wanted to show everybody his great skills for miniaturization and show off that he was the greatest watchmaker. So he actually built a collar around a flea to prove his skills, and it had 22 links and an operating lock so he could let the flea in and out of the collar. And he put it in his store window, and it became something of a competition as the other watchmaker said, well, wait a minute, I could design a circus carousel, or I could design something else that would be flea-powered. And in the days when they didn't have radio and didn't have television, coming to the window there to see what the watchmaker had come up with was a huge advertisement.
We'll check the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
And of course, there's Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
Doesn't it just drive you crazy when somebody who tries to get through an intersection can't make it through because there's too much traffic ahead of that idiot, so they get stuck in the intersection, and then you can't make it through even though you have the green? Jeez, I hate those people. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File Podcast with Peter Anthony Holder.
And, of course, we have lots and lots of stuff, because the show is called the Stuff File Podcast. And we'll get right to the stuff right here, right now, including a little later on, an idiot of the day. But before we get to that, just want to mention, each week on the Stuff File Podcast, as I mentioned on last week's show, we have the opening slate, which tells you the number of the show. And each week I said it was going to be done by somebody else. This week it's actually done by Mike Armstrong, who you'll hear a little later on. Okay? Off to the stuff. We start off with a story from Riverside, California. A man who said he hurled thousands of golf balls into Joshua Tree National Park for more than a year to honor deceased golfers will be explaining his tribute to a federal magistrate. Park rangers cited 57-year-old Douglas Jones for abandoning property, littering, and feeding wildlife. Park spokesman Joe Zarkey said that Jones tossed some 3,000 golf balls from his vehicle. This is a guy with a lot of time on his hands. Jones also scattered a few tennis balls and park literature and left fruit and vegetables along park roads. Apparently, rangers spent 370 hours cleaning up at a cost of $9,000. Finally spotted in action last month, Jones allegedly told rangers he threw the golf balls to leave his mark and honor deceased golfers. The food was for stranded hikers. Okay. Meanwhile, if society were ever attacked by zombies, we would probably be doomed, and quickly. That was the conclusion of two university researchers in Ottawa, our nation's capital here in Canada, who set up mathematical models hypothesizing zombie attacks as infectious diseases with the well-known characteristics of zombie biology from popular fiction. In fact, according to a July BBC News report, zombies are more threatening than virulent diseases because they can regenerate, unless decapitated or incinerated, of course. More troubling was the researchers' presumptions that zombies move slowly, as they did in older movies, but in recent fiction, they're super quick, making them nearly invincible. So, worried about H1N1? Nothing. We got zombies to deal with. And on the program, the old radio show, we often talked about a couple of things on a regular basis. There was people with the middle name Wayne. We haven't got a new one for this yet, but we will, I'm sure, as soon as one is available. And also a segment we like to call Armed and Clumsy. People who are stupid with guns. And I've decided to rename this section, Armed and Clumsy, the Plexico Burris Award. So here's an all-new edition of Armed and Clumsy. More people who accidentally shoot themselves. We start off with a 44-year-old man shoving a gun down his pant leg after an argument with his girlfriend. He blew off his little toe. That was in Alameda, California, back in July. A 21-year-old man, stopping in an alley to urinate with a gun in his pocket, shot himself in the thigh in South Bend, Indiana, also in July. A 26-year-old man teaching gun safety to two people was killed when he fired his supposedly unloaded gun at his own head. This was in Phoenix in May. A 15-year-old boy impulsively grabbed the gun that was slipping down his pants from his waistband and shot himself in the penis. That was in Brooklyn, New York, just in September. And that's the latest edition of Armed and Clumsy, or the Plexico Burris Award. There you go. Let's talk about something a little more romantic, shall we? Let's talk about the roller coaster of love. Yes, the roller coaster of love. Alton Towers has introduced a speed dating service on its roller coasters. Single men and women taking part in the scheme at the Staffordshire theme park will be paired up as they line up for the ride. This is in the UK. Couples will experience their dates at speeds of up to 62 miles an hour on roller coasters such as Rita, Queen of Speed, and Spinball Whizzer. With some rides lasting just 49 seconds, the park has hailed the scheme as the world's fastest date. Morwena Angove, sales and marketing director of the park, said, "We pride ourselves on offering our visitors the ultimate day out or short break and have an amazing combination of adrenaline-inducing rides and attractions. We are confident that combining such thrilling experiences with the added exhilaration of meeting a potential new partner will ensure the most memorable date ever." Wow. I don't know. Maybe it's the non-romantic in me, but I think of so many things that can go wrong. Anyway, the scheme is being piloted all through the month of September. On to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. 39-year-old Anthony Miller really couldn't stand his wife. He desperately wanted to leave her, but she kept threatening to kill herself if he did. That's when he decided the only way was to go to jail. So, he robbed a bank by approaching tellers with a BB gun. He then asked for money and then told the tellers to call the police. He even asked for updates on their efforts to reach authorities as he waited patiently. He got his wish and was just sentenced to 3 to 6 years in prison. But here's the interesting part, because, you know, on the stuff file, there's always an interesting part, as if this story weren't odd enough. The robbery took place back in 2007. It's taken this long for the case to go to trial and sentencing, and ironically, Miller and his wife did indeed divorce last year. Oops. Meanwhile, in Niceville, Florida, and can anything really bad happen in a place called Niceville? This is the stuff file, of course. In Niceville, Florida, a woman has been arrested for attacking another woman who was smoking a cigarette. And the attacker's weapon of choice? A 9-ounce can of Glade Potpourri air freshener. Police were called to an apartment complex where they found the suspect spraying the air freshener around another woman's head. She allegedly sprayed the contents of the can continuously for nearly a minute. The police report quoted the sprayer as saying, "She'll continue to spray the air freshener," and threatened she'd take the case all the way to the Supreme Court, maintaining her right to breathe fresh air. In the meantime, she now faces battery charges. Wow. I wonder what the aroma in the cell she's going to be in will be like, and if she can handle that. And a couple of stories dealing with crocodiles, or alligators, if you will. We take you to a story that takes place in Italy. Here's another of the mafia's trademark offers you can't refuse: pay or be eaten by a crocodile. Italy's anti-mafia police unit said Wednesday it has seized a crocodile used by an alleged Naples mob boss to intimidate local businessmen from whom he demanded protection money. Officers searching for weapons in the man's home outside the southern Italian city found the crocodile living on his terrace. The crocodile weighed 40 kilograms, that's about 88 pounds, and was 5.5 feet long, or 1.7 meters if you like, and was fed a diet of live rabbits and mice, and occasionally delinquent pears, I would assume. The police official said the suspect, an alleged boss in the Naples-based Camorra crime syndicate, used to invite extortion victims to his home and threatened to set the animal on them if they didn't pay or grant him favors. The man was not arrested but placed under investigation for illegal possession of an animal. Police spokesman said the animal is believed to be a caiman, a species that lives in Central or South America, and it is not yet clear how it got to Italy. I'm guessing breaststroke. The crocodile was placed in the care of Italy's forestry service. And while we're on the topic of creatures like that, Pat Yose, a spokesman for the St. Charles Parish, Louisiana Sheriff's Office, says he doesn't know where Taryn D. Ingram, age 38, got the alligator or what he was planning to do with it. But deputies saw Ingram riding a bicycle down the street with a 3-foot-long animal resting on his shoulders. When deputies stopped him, he ran, leaving both his bicycle and his leathery friend behind. The gator was caught and released into a nearby marsh. Ingram was caught and housed in the jail, charged with resisting arrest, cruelty to animals, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Yeah, you knew there had to be drug paraphernalia, right? And finally, in this section of the stuff file, because you know there'll be more sections of the stuff file later, a British store has launched a range of underpants for left-handed men. An innovation, it says, will save them both time and embarrassment in front of the porcelain. You know, I never knew this was an issue with left-handed men, but then again, I'm right-handed. The new range by UK-based Ohm will have a horizontal opening instead of a vertical slit accessed from the right-hand side, breaking with tradition that has lasted for 75 years. In our view, this is a vital step toward equality for left-handed men, according to a spokesperson for one of the department stores. Almost 10% of British men are believed to be left-handed, but men's Y-fronted underpants have traditionally had a left-handed opening from the time they were invented in 1935. As a result, said the spokesperson, left-handed men have to reach much further into their pants, performing a Z-shaped maneuver through two 180-degree angles before achieving the result that right-handed men perform with ease. A lot of thought went into this. Previously, it added boxer shorts with an adaptable ambidextrous opening in the middle have been the underpants of choice for left-handed men. The new pants means that left-handed men can finally go to the bathroom as quickly and efficiently as their right-handed colleagues, the store said. Switching the opening from vertical to horizontal may sound like a small step, but it's a major breakthrough that many have been waiting for. Really? All you people out there who are left-handed, have you really been waiting for this? Really? Wow. This is the Stuff File Podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and as mentioned, we have a lot coming up on the show. We'll talk to a guy who runs a flea circus, also we'll have the mailbag, Steve Walsh, our man of the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation, and a lot more stuff. But right now, Mike Armstrong is a news correspondent for Global National, the flagship newscast on the Global Television Network here in Canada that is helmed by Kevin Newman. Mike is also an avid net surfer and podcast listener, so I had a chance to catch up with Mike at the Global Studios to talk about his career and his enjoyment of the net. Here's the interview. You've been a correspondent now, a national correspondent for Global National for a couple of years now, since the show went on the air, I guess 5 years?
2001. We went on the air just a week before 9/11.
Wow. So what is the biggest misconception from your perspective when you first got the gig? What's the biggest misconception about being a national correspondent?
Jeez, interesting question. The biggest misconception. I have no idea. That's the one I'd really have to think about. I guess I think what I've liked about it is that I've sort of gotten to choose my stories, and I don't have to go to school board meetings and little things that I don't find interesting. So maybe I've been surprised by how I've gotten to pick and choose more often than not, and I get to do what I want to do.
So it's an editorial process that you get to enjoy the most then.
Yeah, I basically very often watch the local newsroom, and I get to pick whichever story interests me the most. In addition to that, if I see something when I'm off on the weekend or something that I think, oh boy, I'd like to see that, I can call the people, and as long as I can pitch it to my desk, I get to go and meet the people that are doing that or see it. I actually one day went to a hockey game, and I saw the T-shirt cannon. They drive around the Bell Center ice, and they fire T-shirts into the stands. I thought, that's pretty neat. And a week later, I was in the back of that little truck driving, doing donuts on the Bell Center ice. That's my job. It's not that hard.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast is the fact that when I did the television show, I did a television show here locally in Montreal, we were in the same building, in the same office, and every time I walked past your door, you would say, have you seen this video? Have you heard this? And you were always finding things online. And just recently, on one of your stories this week, you found a story that was from something that you saw online.
I'm kind of addicted to the internet. It's a bit of a problem. And if you ask my wife, she'll agree with that. I really think that there's so much stuff out there on the internet. And I'm constantly going to websites, sort of aggregator sites that bring together sort of the latest things. And I'd be lying if I didn't say I kind of enjoy finding those videos before other people and being able to pass them on. A bit of pride in that, actually.
Tell us about the story you did just recently, which involved a school here in Quebec.
Well, that was exactly what I was talking about earlier. It was just somebody said, hey, did you see this? So I got to see the video. And then I said, well, that's at Université du Québec à Montréal. It's at UQAM here in Montreal. I said, I bet I can find some of the students that worked on that. Sure enough, called the university, found the students. Now, the video was a 4.5-minute lip dub to I Got a Feeling by Black Eyed Peas. And it's one take or one continuous shot for 4.5 minutes. It's fantastic. And so I wanted to know how they did it and how hard it was. And sure enough, there I got to spend half an hour talking to them about it.
You've also had an opportunity as a national correspondent to travel. Tell us about some of the places you've been to. I know, for instance, you were at Vimy just a little while ago.
Yeah, I consider myself pretty lucky to have been there for the 90th anniversary of the Battle of Vimy Ridge, one of the most important battles in Canadian history. I've also gotten to travel in the U.S. quite a bit. I was in at Hurricane Katrina after it happened in New Orleans, and I was also in Houston and Baton Rouge for that. I got to cover the revolution in Haiti. I was in Indonesia and Thailand for the tsunami. I've had a pretty good seat for some of the big stories in the last decade.
You also were at, if I'm not mistaken, the inauguration of Barack Obama. What was that like?
I described it on air that day as walking through that crowd and seeing how happy some of the African Americans were in that audience listening to that speech. I described it as you almost had to put your hand on people's shoulders to keep their feet on the ground. That's how excited people were. And it was pretty interesting because the mall in Washington was once a market where they sold slaves. And there you were on Inauguration Day, Barack Obama taking the oath of allegiance. It was incredible.
Regardless of the event, be it an inauguration, a tsunami, a hurricane, or even looking back at World War I with Vimy Ridge, how difficult is it or how easy is it to keep your own emotions out of a story that you're covering?
Well, a lot of reporters use the same coping mechanism, which I find is humor. So you'll find us making inappropriate jokes, what may seem to be inappropriate jokes, actually, and I don't think they are in a way, because you can't hang out looking at death and destruction every day without sort of making light of it. That's just how you can cope with it in your head. The only thing I ever had to really walk away from was a refugee camp in northern Sumatra, in Banda Aceh, where there were just kids, who had lost their parents, and they were all sort of drawing and things like that, and you're just watching them thinking, they've just been through the worst natural disaster of my lifetime, of my parents' lifetime. Like, it was just the worst thing ever. And at that point, I looked at my cameraman and said, get what you have to get, take the time you need, I'll be waiting in the truck. And I actually went back to the truck, spent about 15 minutes there, and said, okay, I've caught up with my emotions, and I'm controlling myself now. And I walked back, spent 2 minutes there, and went, nope, can't hang out here. And I've seen, like, lots of bodies and things like that. That didn't bother me, but it was those kids in that refugee camp.
Looking back at some of the stories you've had a chance to cover, if you look back at the tape of some of the stuff you did, what stories are you most proud of?
There were the tsunami sort of gave me some stuff that I was pretty proud of. I mean, there are images that you sort of like, that you write to, and sort of an idea that you build. And that day, there was one day in Bandace where you saw these people walking, looking for loved ones. And looking for loved ones in Bandace that day meant walking up to the piles of bodies and looking at the faces. And this was days after the tsunami, so these bodies weren't in good shape. And they were being stacked with bulldozers and backhoes. And so to see that, and to see people walk away from these piles of bodies crying because they haven't found their loved ones. Basically, they know their loved ones are dead, but they want to at least find the bodies. And that was one of the things that you sort of go, wow, that was a powerful, powerful thing. But, you know, I also have enjoyed letting people tell their own stories, and some of the heroes of World War II that I've met also over the years, and you get to sort of remind people of how important what they went through was. It's been fun.
We started by talking a little bit about your passion for the web, so, and the fact that you're always looking for things. What are some of your favorite sites or podcasts that you listen to or watch?
I'm listening to way less radio than I used to listen to. I am constantly on my iPod. As a matter of fact, my iPod was stolen about a month and a half ago, and I was without it for a month and had to replace it. It was not fun because I was missing. I listen to Dan Carlin, a guy out of the States. He's got a history podcast and a current events podcast. They're great. There's Adam Carolla, if you're looking for some comedy. Well, I sort of disagree with some of his politics, but he's funny. There's a lot of history stuff that I really enjoy. New Yorker's got some great interviews, a new fiction thing that I just found a few days ago that I'm enjoying a lot. As far as online stuff, I'm constantly just refreshing Huffington Post, Drudge Report, all those aggregator sites. As I say, it's a bit of an addiction.
Well, thank you very much for being with us on the program, on the podcast. I won't say goodbye. I'll just let you end this off with a standard sign-off from you.
Mike Armstrong, Global News, Montreal.
You heard the sign-off. That was Mike Armstrong from Global News. He mentioned some of the things that he enjoys on the web. You'll find links to them on my website at peteranthonyholder.com, including a link to the lip-dubbing that the students at UCAM did to the Black Eyed Peas. And by the way, the newscast, Global National, is seen from coast to coast in Canada, and yes, it too is available as a podcast.
You're listening to the Stuff File podcast with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that doesn't fly through the air like a communicable disease.
And this is indeed the Stuff File podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 0003, if you're keeping count and checking the logbooks. Still to come on the program, we'll talk to a guy who runs a flea circus. Also, we'll have the mailbag. We'll have another edition of Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. We have plenty of stuff, including an idiot of the day. And speaking of stuff, we have more stuff right here, right now. And of course, if you're big fans of football, it's the big football season in the NFL. I'm a big football season fan. Watch the NFL a lot. There's also the CFL here in Canada. Well, Philadelphia Eagles fans who are thirsty for predictions on whether their team will win or lose each week won't get them from a New Jersey pigskin prognosticating camel. Princess, that's the camel's name. I don't know why they name him Prince or her Princess. Camels are ugly as sin, but anyway. Princess, the star of Popcorn Park Zoo, won't predict the results of any Eagles games this season to protest the signing of quarterback Michael Vick.
Michael Vick, as you know, spent 18 months in prison for organizing a dogfighting ring.
Who let the dogs out?
The 2,600-pound camel went 17-4 last year and correctly picked the Pittsburgh Steelers to win the Super Bowl. The zoo's manager places a graham cracker in each hand and writes the name of a competing team on each hand. Whichever hand Princess eats from is her pick. Meanwhile, a suburban Philadelphia animal welfare group, Mainline Animal Rescue, announced that it plans to donate dog food for every time Vic is tackled.
Get back, Ruffy. Back, Ruffy. Get back, you flea infested mongrel.
Yeah. Meanwhile, don't bring a waffle to a gunfight, okay? Next time you're eating at the Waffle House on Paxville Highway in Manning, South Carolina, don't mess with 27-year-old waitress Yakisha Ward. Of course, you won't have the chance, as she's in jail now, after a dispute with a customer. Ward got into an argument with customer Crystal Samuel. Samuel allegedly ended up throwing a waffle at the waitress. That's when Ward jumped over the counter, and as Samuel said, we got into it. The fight moved outside, where Ward got a gun from her car, and while she didn't shoot Samuel, she did allegedly pistol whip her in the head. About that time, police rolled up and arrested Ward. As for Miss Samuel, she said she has only one thing to say about Waffle House. Bad customer service. Well, that's putting it mildly, to say the least. Well, big news from Indonesia, where public stoning has made a triumphant return to the law books. Lawmakers in the devoutly Muslim Indonesian province voted unanimously that adulterers can now be sentenced to death by stoning. It's especially surprising because just months ago, voters overwhelmingly chose to throw conservative Islamic parties out of power. But that transition of power doesn't happen for a few weeks yet, so the conservatives got one final old-school tradition. Human rights groups say the law violates international treaties signed by Indonesia. The province's deputy governor also opposed the legislation, saying it needed more careful consideration because it opposes a new form of capital punishment. But just to be safe, in the meantime, we recommend our Indonesian friends stay loyal to their spouses, or you could be in for a really rocky ride, if you know what I mean. And the Shinto temple Kanda Shrine near Tokyo has been doing an amazingly brisk business, blessing electronic gadgets. Our Japanese friends are actually paying $50 for a personal session from a temple priest. Folks are getting their laptops, cell phones, iPods, and more actually blessed under the impression that they will become trouble-free. One patron carrying a troublesome cell phone approached the shrine with a tree branch as instructed, turned it 180 degrees clockwise, and laid it on the altar. After bowing twice and clapping his hands twice, he left, believing he would now have a glitch-free phone. Well, goody for him. You're listening to the Stuff File podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, let's go to the circus. The flea circus. I suppose this would be a circus for those with really good eyesight. On the line with us right now is Walter Noon, who has a flea circus, and thus he is also a flea trainer. Walt, first of all, how does one get into the flea training business?
That is an impossible question. In my case, I was working as a professional magician, and I designed props for entertainers that did all sorts of strange acts. So somebody asked me to build...
Oh, so are you responsible for Carrot Top, by the way?
No, it's not me.
Okay. Because I'm looking for that person.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, no, he's a little bit... I don't know if he's farther off in space than a flea or not, but... But, you know, if he's interested in a flea circus, definitely have him give me a call when you talk to him.
Okay.
But, yeah, and a gentleman just said, can you build me a flea circus? And the thing that amazed me as somebody that's designed and built all sorts of strange contraptions for people was how little information there was on flea circuses. And as I dug into it and It turned out there's a Flea Historical Society only in Canada, by the way, in Port Hope, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And a few little groups that gave me some clues on what to look for and what to do, but not many folks remain from something that really had its heyday in the 1930s.
Yeah, this does have this does have a certain amount of history, and you say the 1930s, but it goes back way before that, correct?
For sure, yeah. As a matter of fact, the earliest reference I've seen was from the 1500s. And there are anecdotal references from before that, but that's the first one that seems very solid. And there was a blacksmith, a watchmaker, who wanted to show everybody his great skills for miniaturization and show off that he was the greatest watchmaker. So he actually built a collar around a flea to prove his skills, and it had 22 links and an operating lock so he could let the flea in and out of the collar. And he put it in his store window, and it became something of a competition as the other watchmaker said, well, wait a minute, I could design a circus carousel, or I could design something else that would be flea-powered. And in the days when they didn't have radio and didn't have television, coming to the window there to see what the watchmaker had come up with was a huge advertisement.
Okay, so wait a minute. Let's back up a second. First of all, how large is a flea? Or how small, I guess, is the question, is a flea?
They range in size, but what I've always told people when they're reading a page or a comment or something I made is look at the period on the page, of any printed page you're looking at, and you're looking at about the size of what I'm working with when I've got my performers out.
Okay. So how does one, first of all, where does one find fleas? And
that's the best question. I love it. You know, that is really tricky, and that has been the downfall of a lot of circuses, especially traveling. Because for something that's so incredibly difficult to get rid of when they're on your dogs and in your house, they're really tough to keep alive when you want to keep one as a pet. So the place that you're always restocking and getting new fleas, and the places I usually do it is I will take out an advertisement in the town where I'm planning on performing, and I will ask people to please make their fleas available to me, and people do call, and it ends up being a publicity stunt at the same time because people go crazy when they see ads looking for fleas. But it's actually necessary in order to perform the act.
I'm reminded of the Monty Python movie where somebody's screaming, bring out your dead.
Right, yeah, bring out your fleas from the dead. A lot of entomologists told me that the best place to get fleas was a recently killed animal because they're eager to leave, and if you just show up, they'll jump right to you.
Okay, so the $64,000 question, since you are a flea trainer,
yeah,
how do you train a flea?
You know, there is a limited number of things that you can get a flea to do, but they actually are...
Well, I can say the same about some humans, too, so it's...
True, and there's a lot of comparisons. There have been fleas in... You know, I've thought about that in recent history, but there have been fleas in past history that have been taught to do imitations of humans just by behaviors that were observed in the flea. So there are humans today that I could apply it to, and I'm working on that. But you can train a flea. The primary thing that every performer wants to do first is to train a flea not to jump. And that's a tricky thing to do because if you have fleas that jump, your circus isn't going to last very long. It's going to be in the audience almost right away. But it's possible that if you take a flea from the pupa stage and keep him in a very small container, I use a little test tube, every time from the day he's born that he jumps, he bangs his head on a test tube. So he develops a behavior of associating jumping with a bang on the head. And you wind up with fleas that don't jump, and they walk around your stage, and they take my chariots from place to place and do all the different acts.
What is the lifespan of a flea, by the way?
Well, that has been very debated, and my opinion on it has changed a lot recently. I met a man named John Torp, who's over in Switzerland, I believe, and is one of the last remaining actual flea trainers. His fleas lived 8 months in a circus, and that was while they were performing. Normally, a flea only lives about 30 days, according to most of the flea people and the entomologists, although they can go into a dormant phase where they sleep for up to 2 years waiting to activate when they feel the vibrations from your foot and jump to your ankle.
Mm.
So it's funny, but as far as being active and awake, ordinarily a flea would only last about 30 days. So in the circus, they actually have a much longer life than they do. My fleas, I'm working up there. I'm up to about 2 months on a flea. That's my world record so far. So I'm not as kind as John Torp or as developed, but I'm working on it.
Well, something that lives that short is hard to unionize. That's
one advantage. It's true. Yeah, although if they gang up on you, you know, they're definitely like lawyers in a lot of ways.
Now, the thing that I find rather interesting is, again, as you said earlier, fleas are something that people are usually trying to get away from.
Right.
And get rid of. So isn't there the concern that... if someone comes to a flea circus, there's a chance they might catch fleas?
Well, as you know, we don't allow dogs or cats at the show because that's too much temptation for the fleas. and we usually use dog and cat fleas. But most of our fleas are in collars for all the acts that they perform, so we always let people know that any fleas they leave with are fleas they brought themselves.
Dogs or cats you don't allow, but what about people with unkempt hair?
Well, you know, I don't think I've had a deserter in a long time, but I have had people actually bring bug spray to a show, which I find...
Oh, I like that. So, again, so what are some of the stunts? You don't want to get them to jump. That's one thing you don't want. But I understand you have... you had fleas master death-defying stunts like high dives...
Indeed. Now, that's a stunt, as you know, I like to draw a little bit of a differentiation. Some performers use a lot of humbug in their act, and what really turns me on...
Humbug?
A humbug in that, you know, if a flea's on a dive board and you jitter the dive board, he's going to jump and wind up in the pool. But it's, to me, that's not a trained behavior. It's a bit of a humbug. It's a bit of a stunt where you're sort of tricking the flea into doing it.
That's like the dancing duck on the hot plate.
You've got it. As a matter of fact, I would often take a flea and put him on top of a music box, because the vibration will send him into a crazy dance.
Okay.
Same kind of a thing. But as far as actual trained behaviors, you can actually teach a flea to juggle, and they'll take a little... In the olden days, they used a pith ball.
To juggle what?
You know, from a beanbag chair, you remember those little tiny styrofoam balls?
Yeah.
That's what I use. And you can actually... They get used to it, and they seem to like it. I don't know if there's a static attraction or what, but they'll juggle it from foot to foot, and they'll play with it for the longest time. They'll even pass it back and forth. You can do flea soccer and have a competition.
Now, people who come to your flea circus, do they require a magnifying glass? I would assume 20/20 vision helps to see a flea circus.
It helps a lot. And in the olden days, a lot of times what they would do is the circus was free, but they would charge you for a magnifying lens. And it was a way to make some money and bring a lot of people around. So. Mm. That does help, and usually I get someone to verify that what they're seeing is real with a magnifying lens. And I have a flea that I'll pass out for everybody to take a look at that's in a collar, who safely won't get anybody. Somebody wants to feed him, they can. It's definitely up to them.
Feed them what?
You know, there's only one thing that a flea eats. So human blood is my best recommendation.
Wow.
They probably prefer a cat. The interesting thing is that the fleas that were traditional in the circus were Culex irritans, which are the human flea, and human fleas don't hurt when they bite you. They're adapted to us, and they'll get away with it. So you can, if you're using human fleas, you're home free.
Mm. Now, you mentioned magnifying glass. Aren't you worried? I guess your flea circuses are usually... first of all, where do you have your flea circus? Do you go to state fairs, or do you have an indoor setting?
You know, it's a lot like doing the magic act, in that I never know who or what group would be interested in seeing fleas. The logical places I've done, like the National Geographic television show, and they came out and they filmed the circus. And the illogical places that I really got a kick out of were Hearts Mountain, the people that make the flea...
Flea collar?
They hired us to come out and do a flea circus for their big trade shows and all that sort of stuff.
Because I'm assuming indoors is the best thing. Because, you know, if you got a flea and a magnifying glass and sunshine, that's not a good combination.
No. As a matter of fact, I've had several flea disasters, and I was only slightly relieved to find out that performers throughout history have the same things happen. But with the airport security these days, when you travel with a case full of tubes and wires and all those sorts of things, you're automatically taken aside, and they spray it down with chemicals to look for whatever they're looking for. And those chemicals are the most wonderful insecticide, I think, ever discovered by man. And they have not only destroyed a troupe when I was going somewhere to perform, but the residue that remained destroyed my circus. I had to actually build another circus, because any flea I put on there was dead in about 20 seconds. So maybe the insecticide people will take a note from whatever's being... You know, that's kind of scary that they're spraying us with that stuff.
How long does it take you to build a circus?
3 weeks from the ground up, and that's if I'm working on it every day.
Mm.
And I have an artist that'll help me with a lot of the fine art type of detail on it, but I really try to make each one a real work of art.
Okay, so we mentioned the high dives and the high wire act, but the chariot races?
Yeah, that's one of the most amazing things. And a flea, this is hard to believe, and I have no way to verify it. Someday if I ever have the means, I'll probably test it, but can carry 160,000 times their weight. So I built chariots out of modified Hot Wheels cars and wires, and I will tie a single flea to that, And they have an explosive compound in their leg that allows them to jump up to 30,000 times. It's called Resilin. And when you tie them to a chariot and you give them a little carbon dioxide to get them going, they jump and jump and jump, and they'll pull a Hot Wheels car.
Okay, so they're the horse in the chariot race. They're not Charlton Heston.
Well, you've given me an idea I hadn't even thought of. What have I been thinking? We've got no drivers. That's a great idea.
I'm just trying to picture a flea in a little toga.
Well, a funny thing was...
Or those little tunics that they wore then.
This is something that is also a historical thing, was they used to dress fleas in clothing. And that was another thing they charged for. And in Mexico, they used to do an entire diorama in a walnut, and they would place the flea in there in a set of clothing and allow the flea to dance inside the walnut. And that's something I've actually seen.
Wow.
You're not far off. You're not far off.
Yeah. Now, what is the ideal? I mean, you're in California. What is the ideal temperature for a flea?
You know, it's a little bit lower than skin temperature, actually. And they need quite a bit of humidity if they're going to be active. And that was the thing that got my first couple of troops only lived a couple of weeks, and I just couldn't figure it out. But I met a gentleman who invented the artificial dog, which is what laboratories are using. And he gave me a complete grilling on how I was treating my fleas, and so I'm a little more scientific now.
Mm. Well, people can check out the website, which is flea-circus.com. That's www.flea-circus.com. Walt, I thank you very, very much.
Very cool. Thank you very much.
Walt Noon, who runs a flea circus. Again, you can check out his website at flea-circus.com. That's flea-circus.com. And you can find all the links on the What's On page for this edition of the podcast, 0003, on my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Well, I see by the clock on the wall, it's time for the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
As we check the mail of some of the things that have come in while we have been doing this program over the short 3 weeks that it's been on the net, we start off with an email from Ferguson. It came in at my blog. It says, maybe you've already done this, but it would be nice to be able to subscribe automatically to your podcast through the iTunes Music Store. That way people could automatically get the latest episode on their iPod. Ferguson, check iTunes. It's already there. As a matter of fact, I got an email from a fellow by the name of Hugh, which kind of answers your email. I just wanted to let you know that I've been listening to your podcast and loving them. It's great to hear you again. Glad you're on iTunes, too. So thank you. And you see, Ferguson, they're on iTunes. You can find them. And thanks for writing. Thanks for listening. By the way, somebody else who was listening to the show is a fellow by the name of Keith Perrin, who hosts a program called Happy Station Radio. He actually lives in Taipei, Taiwan. And he interviewed me for his radio show, and I have the air dates when that show will air. You'll find it online. And just, I guess you can Google Happy Station Radio, but you can also find it via shortwave. The interview that I did with Keith will be airing on his program on several dates, Thursday, October 1st, I should say. It'll be on shortwave directed to North America and the Caribbean, and that will be at 11 a.m. Eastern. On October 2nd, which is Friday, at 3 a.m., it'll be on shortwave directed to the west coast of Canada and the U.S. On October the 3rd, which is Saturday, at 6 a.m., it'll be directed to Redwood, Wellington, New Zealand. And on October the 4th, which is Sunday, it'll be heard across Indonesia on various AM and FM frequencies. But as I said, you could also go online and find out more information about that and check it out. And I have the links for all those times I just mentioned. And I also have the links, for those of you who are into shortwave, to the frequencies. I'm not going to read all the frequencies now because shortwave frequencies, reading those out, it's just a lot of numbers. So go to my website and you'll find all the information there.
Incoming subspace signal.
And finally, an email came in from Gwen. She says, enjoying the podcast, used to listen to the show on the radio. I noticed that you haven't said tickety-boo yet. Well, I've just said tickety-boo. How come you haven't said it, and what is the origin of you saying this on the air? Okay, here's the situation. Doing a talk show on an open line radio program or a phone-in show of any kind,
The old show, we had 6 to 8 lines that we could go to, depending upon the situation, for callers. And a lot of times, people would be on hold, waiting for the caller who was on before them to finish on the air. And so they'd be hearing whatever was going on through the course of the show while they were waiting on hold. And the one thing people would always do, perhaps because sometimes they were nervous or just plain polite, every single person who called in would start the conversation by, "Hi, how are you?" And you know, I just said I was fine to the last dozen callers who were on before. So at one point I got tired of saying that, especially considering if they were on hold, they already know how I am because they heard it from the last dozen callers. So I just started saying, "Tickety-boo." And it stuck. And it stuck for about, 10, 15 years. And it's become a catchphrase for me. And as a result, one of a listener actually sent me in a picture. She went to, I believe it was somewhere in the UK, either Scotland or England. And she went to a pub, which was called Tickety-boo. And she took a picture of the pub and sent me the picture, which is hanging in my office at home on the wall of my bulletin board. So there you go. So thanks for noticing, Glenn, and I hope you, Gwen, rather, and I hope you're tickety-boo. We have more stuff from the Stuff File coming your way here on the Stuff File podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And we also have Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. This has been The Mailbag on the Stuff File podcast.
This is the Stuff File. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
I'm happier than a pig in a whole bunch of nasty, dirty stuff on a Saturday afternoon.
Nice.
I almost said something else there, you know.
Nice capture on the edit there, the self-editing.
Yeah, that was pretty good, huh?
Very nice.
How did you know I was going there? Could you tell?
No, Ernie asked this for you.
Yeah, I'm safe. I caught myself before I caught myself.
Exactly.
Wouldn't be the first time.
I know. What's the weather like where you are in Missouri?
Oh gosh, it's wonderful and warm and cozy and waiting for the Cardinals playoffs to get underway. I mean, playoffs, as we always tell people in places like Kansas City, St. Louis and Kansas City are different. Playoffs for the folks in Kansas City, that's what happens when the regular season ends.
Yeah,
Kansas City folks don't know that.
It's much like Montreal and Toronto, but I digress.
I understand.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you have hockey.
Yes.
You have hockey.
Yes.
Yeah, we have hockey, too. It's just I know you're a big baseball fan.
Yes, yeah.
I know, and that's why I tell you stories of the St. Louis Cardinals. Oh, I love baseball.
Yeah.
That's why. See?
Anyway, sir.
Yes.
What do you have for us this week?
Oh, well, let's see where we begin. Hang on. Okay, here we go. Dateline, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, that'd be the Sooner State.
Where the wind comes sweeping across the plain.
Yes.
Yes, a crowd of at least 3,500 came to the Big Splash Water Park in Tulsa for a special evening event promoted by a radio station there. Police say large-scale fights broke out among the crowd within 90 minutes of the evening opening. The single security guard on duty was quickly overwhelmed, and 35 to 50 police officers were needed to get the park shut down.
Mm.
You know what the special event was?
What was that?
Waves of Worship, a Christian youth night.
By the way, sir, as you know, this is the podcast, and we're no longer on radio.
Right.
So what is that radio station? Because in the past, we never gave other stations call letters. But
we never did. That's true. We'll give the call letters, and it is KXOJ.
KXOJ.
That's right. Ooh. KXOJ.
Wow.
In Tulsa.
I wonder how they did during the trial.
Yeah, this is something. You got to watch these. You know, there's nothing scarier than a bunch of young Christians going nuts. I mean,
I know.
I mean, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. Please don't write. It's not meant to anything anti-Christian or anything like that. I mean, I'm just saying it's young people. I could say young, well-behaved people going nuts.
There you go.
The Amish going nuts. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, okay.
All right. Dateline, Elizabethton, Tennessee.
That'd be the volunteer state.
Yeah, it's one of my neighbors, you know, Tennessee.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, a lot of neighbors from Missouri. Anyway, a Northeast Tennessee deputy sheriff who went to the wrong house came back with his man anyway. The incident occurred when Carter County Sheriff's Deputy Richard Barnett responded to a domestic disturbance call, but mistakenly knocked on the door of the wrong house. A 33-year-old man invited him in. Then the man put his hands behind his back for handcuffing and told Barnett, well, he said he was ready to go to jail, saying he had an outstanding arrest warrant. He was found guilty of contempt and violating probation for failing to pay fines and complete an anger management course from an earlier incident. That's the key. He didn't complete the anger management course.
Mm. You know, sometimes it's just like shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes you're lucky. In Elizabethton, Tennessee, that's what happens. Plenty of fish, plenty of barrels, lots of guns.
There you go.
State line, Wichita, Kansas.
And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Still on the line, yes.
That would be...
Go Jayhawks.
I was about to say, that would be the Jayhawk state.
Or the Sunflower state, if you prefer. A tender moment in a trash bin went all wrong for a couple who found themselves being held up at pocket knife point. Remember, a tender moment in a trash bin. Police say two 44-year-olds had climbed into a dumpster to be alone one Saturday night when two men interrupted them and demanded their belongings. Officers said the man and the woman were engaged in an intimate moment when they were robbed of their shoes, their jewelry, the man's wallet. The suspects were found a short time later, and the stolen property was returned. Okay, call me madcap, but who wants to get it on in a trash bin?
Okay, this is the state of Kansas. Should I say it, or should you say it?
I won't say it. They're my neighbors. They'll hurt me.
Okay. Would this be the literal meaning of white trash?
Oh, man, that's mean.
Okay, just...
That's cruel.
I'm just asking.
Oh, so right.
Okay.
You got it.
Gotcha.
Dateline, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
The Badger State.
Or as we like to call it...
The Cheese State.
Where the motto is...
If it's cheddar...
It's better... An Illinois man was accused of stealing more than $45,000 worth of eyeglasses from suburban Milwaukee stores because he enjoys being around eyewear. Jerry Lowry, he's 38 years old, by the way, he was charged with three counts, count them three, of armed robbery and one count of fleeing an officer. The charges carry a maximum penalty of more than 120 years in prison, big fine, too. Prosecutors say Lowry walked into three shops between April and July, said he had a gun. They say he took more than 500 pairs of high-end glasses. This is amazing. See, he didn't take cash, though, just the glasses.
Mm.
The criminal complaint quotes Lowry as saying he really likes to be around glasses. He tries them on in front of a mirror, then tosses them away most of the time.
Wow.
This is not normal.
Well, you know what's not normal about it is the fact that if he's going to be a criminal in this kind of way, and he's stealing high-end glasses and just throwing them away, he could sell these things. But anyway...
I think he could, you know, but it's like that John Fred and his Playboy band song, Judy in Disguise, with glasses.
Ah, yes.
Yes, we all remember that. Mm-hmm. Dateline, Faulkner County, Arkansas.
That'll be the natural state.
Land of opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah, sheriff's deputies in Faulkner County responded to a residence on Billy Goat Mountain on a report that a man riding an ATV had stolen various items from a shed. When the resident confronted the burglar, he fled and crashed the ATV into a beehive. The burglar then abandoned the ATV and set off into the woods on foot. Deputies found a stolen tractor nearby. It had apparently been the burglar's first vehicle, but the thief had gotten it stuck between two trees. The ATV also turned out to have been stolen. Deputies found the man nearby lying unconscious, foaming at the mouth. He'd been stung 50 to 100 times. After hospital treatment, Ricky Dale Ford, who now lives, as I mentioned before, on Nanny Goat Lane, not Billy Goat Mountain, Nanny Goat Lane, was booked on multiple felony theft counts.
Oh,
somebody,
man.
Got his goat.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Running from the fuzz and ran into the buzz.
Yeah, I like that. Well, that'll get me upset, though. Getting stung that many times by bees, I'd get angry.
Certainly got the bees upset.
Got the bees upset, but the bees don't do what I do.
What's that?
I take keyboard in hand and write a two-minute tirade.
Absolutely.
And I have one, if I may.
Tirade away.
Okay, I want to talk about driving habits, Peter. Anyone who's ever driven in Manhattan knows about the gridlock busters. They bust gridlock. Gridlock is caused when a car enters an intersection, then cannot make it through the intersection before the light changes. And he's stuck in the intersection and is blocking other cars from getting through because he's stuck in the intersection. New York gives big fines to these idiots because they gum up the works and create gridlock. They're stuck in the east-west direction, and people heading north-south can't get through. The rules of the road state you are not supposed to enter an intersection unless you're sure you can clear the intersection before the light changes. Do people obey this rule? No. Is it enforced in other parts of the country and continent? No. Cops are still too busy wasting their time writing tickets for people who are driving a few miles an hour above the speed limit, keeping flow with the traffic and causing problems for no one. But it's all about revenue generation, isn't it? Well, I'm going to wager that if the cops were to clamp down on the people who bring us gridlock, we'd see a smoother flow of traffic. There'd be fewer stressful moments. And for the greenheads out there, there would be less waste of fuel and fewer fumes going into the environment. Bottom line, if you can't clear the intersection, stop and wait for the next rotation of the lights. And to the cops, when you see these scofflaws causing traffic snafus, write them tickets!
Wow. Steve?
Yes?
You're in Jefferson City, Missouri.
That's correct, yes, yes.
When do you ever see anything remotely close to gridlock?
The intersection of U.S. 50 and Missouri State 179.
Really?
Yeah, we have an intersection here where people are turning, and it just drives me up a wall. I want to get out of the car, and if I had a conceal and carry permit, who knows what I'd do?
I do.
This is Missouri, remember?
I know. In any case, sir, we're just about out of time.
Okay.
So, and boy, I can hear you crystal clear.
Isn't that great? What are you using?
Skype. Wave of the future.
I've heard of this.
Yes. Anyway, sir.
I'll have to think of getting one. You want me to say those three magic words?
Please do.
Okay. Hit the theme!
This is the Stuff File.
And we're running late. Gotta go. Just enough time for one more Stuff File story, which means this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Two home invaders in East St. Louis, Illinois, holding 11 people hostage as police surrounded the house, were eventually tricked outside by the captives and arrested. The hostages, borrowing an idea from several movie scripts, convinced the invaders that their only shot at freedom was to change clothes to look less conspicuous and then to release everyone. The two would appear to be part of the hostage group, and the hostages promised to tell police that the home invaders had already escaped earlier. However, as everyone walked out, the captives merely pointed out to the police the two invaders. Why would these two clowns believe what their captives would have said if they got out scot-free? Well, because they're idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this week's edition of the Stuff File Podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you'll tell all your friends. Hope you'll come back next week for another edition. We want to get this out there as much as possible to as many people as possible. So I'm hoping that you will spread the word. The website is peteranthonyholder.com, where you'll find information and links on our program and our guests on the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding date and podcast number, in this case 0003, and you'll find all the information. You could email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook account is facebook.com/PAHolder, or at Twitter, twitter.com/PAHolder. That's it for this week's edition of the Stuff File Podcast. See you next time, same bat channel. Bye-bye.
been listening to the Stuff File podcast with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.